Chapter 5. The Scoop. 1. Entombed in the overdecorated confines of the Bounty Tavern, drinking buck-a-bottle Heinekens and laughed at by David Bright, who had sunk to vulgar depths of humor, who had even ended up comparing John Leandro to Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, Leandro had wavered. No use telling himself otherwise. He had, indeed, wavered. But men of vision have always had to endure barbs of ridicule, and not a few have been burned or crucified or had their height artificially extended by 5 or 6 inches on the inquisitorial rack of pain for their visions. Having David Bright ask him over beers in the Bounty if his secret wristwatch was in good working order was hardly the worst thing that could have befallen him. But, oh, shit. It hurt. John Leandro determined that David Bright, and anyone else to whom Bright had related Crazy Johnny's ideas that something big was going on in Haven, would end up laughing on the other side of his or her face. Because something big was going on there. He felt it in every bone in his body. There were days when the wind was blowing from the southeast that he almost imagined he could smell it. His vacation had begun the previous Friday. He had hoped to go down to Haven that very day, but he lived with his widowed mother, and she had been counting so on him running her up to Nova Scotia to see her sister, she said. But if John had commitments, why, she understood. After all, she was old and probably not much fun anymore. Just someone to cook his meals and wash his underwear, and that was fine. You go on, Johnny, go on and hunt up your scoop. I'll just call Megan on the telephone. Maybe in a week or two your cousin Alfie will bring her down to see me. Alfie's so good to his mother, etc., etc., ibid, ibid, ad infinitum. On Friday, Leandro took his mother to Nova Scotia. Of course, they stayed over, and by the time they got back to Bangor, Saturday was shot. Sunday was a bad day to begin anything, what with his Sunday school class of first and second graders at 9, full worship services at 10, and Young Men for Christ in the Methodist Rectory at 5 p.m. At the YMC meeting, a special speaker gave them a slideshow on Armageddon, as he explained to them how unrepenting sinners would be inflicted with boils and running sores and ailments of the bowels and the intestines. Georgina Leandro and the other members of the ladies' aid passed out paper cups of Xarex and oatmeal cookies. And during the evening, there was always a song fest for Christ in the church basement. Sundays always left him feeling exalted and exhausted. 2. So it was Monday, the 15th of August, before Leandro finally tossed his yellow legal pads, his Sony tape recorder, his Nikon, and a gadget bag filled with film and various lenses into the front seat of his used Dodge and prepared to set out for Haven, and what he hoped would be journalistic glory. He would not have been appalled if he had known he was approaching ground zero of what was shortly to become the biggest story since the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. The day was calm and blue and mellow, very warm, but not so savagely hot and humid as the last few days had been. It was a day everyone on earth would mark forever in his memory. Johnny Leandro had wanted a story, but he had never heard the old proverb that goes, "God says, take what you want and pay for it." He only knew that he had stumbled onto the edge of something, and when he tried to wiggle it, it remained firm, which meant it was maybe bigger than one might at first think. There was no way he was going to walk away from this. He intended to excavate. All the David Brights in the world with their smart cracks about Jimmy Olsen wristwatches and Fu Manchu could not stop him. He put the Dodge in drive and began to roll away from the curb. "Don't forget your lunch, Johnny," his mother called. She came puffing down the walk with a brown paper sack in one hand. Large grease spots were already forming on the brown paper. Since grade school, Leandro's favorite sandwich had been bologna, slices of Bermuda onion, and Wesson oil. "Thanks, Mom," he said, leaning over to take the bag and put it down on the floor. You didn't have to do that, though. I could have picked up a hamburger. If I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, she said. You have no business going into those roadside luncheonettes, Johnny. You never know if the kitchen's dirty or clean. Microbes, she said, ominously, leaning forward. Ma, you can't see microbes at all, Mrs. Leandro went on. She was not to be turned from her subject until she had had her say on it. Yes, Mom, Leandro said, resigned. Some of those places are just havens for microbes, she said. The cooks may not be clean, you know. They may not wash their hands after leaving the lavatory. They may have dirt or even excrement under their nails. This isn't anything I want to discuss, you understand, but sometimes a mother has to instruct her son. Food in places like that can make a person very, very sick. Mom, she uttered a long-suffering laugh and dabbed momentarily at the corner of one eye with her apron. Oh, I know. Your mother is silly, just a silly old woman with a lot of funny old ideas, and she probably ought to just learn to shut up. Leandro recognized this for the manipulative trick it was, but it still always made him feel squirmy, guilty, about 8 years old. No, Mom, he said, I don't think that at all. I mean, you are the big newsman. I just sit home and make your bed and wash your clothes and air out your bedroom if you get the farts from drinking too much beer. Leandro bent his head, said nothing, and waited to be released. But do this for me. Stay out of roadside luncheonettes, Johnny, because you can get sick from microbes. I promise, Mom. Satisfied that she had extracted a promise from him, she was now willing to let him go. You'll be home for supper? Yes, Leandro said, not knowing any better. At 6? She persisted. Yes, yes. I know, I'm just a silly old... Bye, Mom, he said hastily and pulled away from the curb. He looked in the rearview mirror and saw her standing at the end of the walk, waving. He waved back, then dropped his hand, hoping she would go back into the house, and knowing better. When he made a right turn 2 blocks down and his mother was finally gone, Leandro felt a faint but unmistakable lightening of his heart. Rightly or wrongly, he always felt this way when his mom finally dropped out of sight. 3. In Haven, Bobby Anderson was showing Jim Gardner some modified breathing apparatus. Ev Hillman would have recognized it. The respirators looked very similar to the one he had picked up for the cop, Butch Dugan. But that one had been to protect Dugan from the Haven air. The respirators Bobby was demonstrating drew on reserves of just that. Haven air was what they were used to, and Haven air was what the two of them would breathe if they got inside the Tommyknocker ship. It was 9:30. At that same time, in Derry, John Leandro had pulled over to the side of the road not far from the place where the gutted deer and the cruiser requisitioned to officers Rhodes and Gabbins had been found. He thumbed open the glove compartment to check on the Smith & Wesson 38 he had picked up in Bangor the week before. He took it out for a moment, not putting his forefinger anywhere near the trigger, even though he knew it was unloaded. He liked the compact way the gun fitted his palm, its weight, the feeling of simple power it somehow conveyed. But it also made him feel a trifle skittery, as if he might have torn off a chunk of something that was far too big for the likes of him to chew. A chunk of what? He wasn't quite sure. Some sort of strange meat. Microbes, his mother's voice spoke up in his mind. Food in places like that can make a person very, very sick. He checked to make sure the carton of bullets was still in the glove compartment, then put the gun back. He guessed that transporting a handgun in the glove compartment of a motor vehicle was probably against the law. He thought again of his mother, this time without even realizing he was doing so. He could imagine a cop pulling him over for something routine, asking to see his registration and getting a glimpse of the 38 when Leandro opened the glove compartment. That was the way murderers always got caught on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which he and his mother watched every Saturday night on the cable station that showed it. It would also be a scoop of a different sort. Bangor Daily News reporter arrested on illegal weapons charge. Well then, take your registration out of the glove compartment and put it in your wallet if you're so worried. But he wouldn't do that. The idea made perfect sense, but it also seemed like buying trouble. And that voice of reason sounded altogether too much like the voice of his mother, warning him about microbes or instructing him, as she had when he was a boy, on the horrors which might result if he forgot to put paper all over the ring of a public toilet before sitting on it. Leandro drove on instead, aware that his heart was beating a little too fast, and that he felt just a little sweatier than the heat of the day could explain. Something big. Some days I can almost smell it. Yes, something was out there, all right. The death of the McCausland woman. A furnace explosion in July. Oh, really? The disappearance of the investigating troopers. The suicide of the cop who had supposedly been in love with her. And before any of those things, there had been the disappearance of the little boy. David Bright had said David Brown's grandfather had been spouting a lot of crazy nonsense about telepathy and magic tricks that really worked. I only wish you'd come to me instead of Bright, Mr. Hillman, Leandro thought for perhaps the 50th time. Except now, Hillman had disappeared. Hadn't been back to his rooming house in over 2 weeks. Hadn't been back to Derry Home Hospital to visit his grandson, although the nurses had had to boot him out nights before. The official state police line was that Ev Hillman hadn't disappeared, but that was catch 22, because a legal adult couldn't disappear in the eyes of the law until another legal adult so reported that person, filling out the proper forms in consequence. So all was Jake in the eyes of the law. All was far from Jake in the eyes of John Leandro. Hillman's landlady told him that the old man had stiffed her for $60. As far as Leandro had been able to find out, it was the first unpaid bill the old guy had left in his life. Something big. Strange meat. Nor was that all of the weirdness emanating out of Haven these days. A fire, also in July, had killed a couple on the Nista Road. This month, a doctor piloting a small plane had crashed and burned. That had happened in Newport, true, but the FAA controller at BIA had confirmed that the unfortunate doc had overflown Haven, and at an illegally low altitude. Phone service in Haven had begun to get oddly glitchy. Sometimes people could get through, sometimes they couldn't. He had sent to the Augusta Bureau of Taxation for a list of Haven voters, paying the required fee of $6 to get the 9 computer sheets, and had managed to trace relatives of nearly 60 of these Havenites, relatives living in Bangor, Derry, and surrounding areas, in his spare time. He couldn't find one, not one, who had seen his or her Haven relations since July 10th or so, over a month before. Not one. Of course, a lot of those he interviewed didn't find this strange at all. Some of them weren't on good terms with their Haven relations, and couldn't care less if they didn't hear from or see them in the next 6 months or 6 years. Others seemed first surprised, then thoughtful, when Leandro pointed out the length of time they were talking about. Of course, summer was an active season for most people. Time passed with a light easiness that winter knew nothing about. And, of course, they had spoken to Aunt Mary or Brother Bill a time or two on the phone. Sometimes you couldn't get through, but mostly you could. There were other suspicious similarities in the testimony of the people Leandro interviewed, similarities that had made his nose flare with the smell of something decidedly off. Ricky Berenger was a house painter in Bangor. His older brother Newt was a carpenter contractor who also happened to be a Haven selectman. We invited Newt up for dinner near the end of July, Ricky said, but he said he had the flu. Don Blue was a Derry realtor. His aunt Sylvia, who lived in Haven, had been in the habit of coming up to take dinner with Don and his wife every Sunday or so. The last 3 Sundays she had begged off. Once with the flu. Flu seems to be going around in Haven, Leandro thought. Nowhere else, you understand. Just in Haven. And the other times because it was so hot she just didn't feel like traveling. After further questioning, Blue realized it had been more like 5 Sundays since his aunt had favored them, and maybe as many as 6. Bill Spruce kept a herd of dairy cows in Cleves Mills. His brother Frank kept a herd in Haven. They usually got together every week or two, merging 2 extremely large families for a few hours. The clan Spruce would eat tons of barbecue, drink gallons of beer and Pepsi-Cola, and Frank and Bill would sit either at the picnic table in Frank's backyard or on the front porch of Bill's house and compare notes about what they simply called the business. Bill admitted it had been a month or more since he'd seen Frank. There had been some problem, first with his feed supplier, Frank had told him, then with the milk inspectors. Bill, meanwhile, had had a few problems of his own. 6 of his Holsteins had died during this last hot spell. And, he added as an afterthought, his wife had had a heart attack. He and his brother just hadn't had time to visit much this summer. But the man had still expressed unfeigned surprise when Leandro dragged out his wallet calendar and the two of them figured out just how long it had been. The two brothers hadn't gotten together since June 30th. Spruce whistled and tilted his cap back on his head. "Gorry, that is a long time," he had said. "Guess I'll have to take a ride down Haven and see Frank, now that my Evelyn's on the mend." Leandro said nothing, but some of the other testimony he had gathered over the last couple of weeks made him think that Bill Spruce might find a trip like that hazardous to his health. "Felt like I was dying," Alvin Rutledge told Leandro. Rutledge was a long-haul trucker, currently unemployed, who lived in Bangor. His grandfather was Dave Rutledge, a lifelong Haven resident. "What exactly do you mean?" Leandro asked. Alvin Rutledge looked at the young reporter shrewdly. "Now the beard go down good just about now," he said. They were sitting in Nan's Tavern in Bangor. "Talkin's amazing dusty work, chummy."
"Isn't it?" Leandro said, and told the waitress to draw 2.
Rutledge took a deep swallow when it came, wiped foam from his upper lip with the heel of his hand, and said, "Heart beating too fast. Headache. Felt like I was going to puke my guts out. I did puke, as a matter of fact, just before I turned around. Rolled down the window and just let her fly into the slipstream, I did."
"Wow," Leandro said, since some remarks seemed called for.
The image of Rutledge letting her fly into the slipstream flapped in his mind. He dismissed it. At least he tried. "And look a-here." He rolled back his upper lip, revealing the remains of his teeth.
"Or see a hole in front?"
Rutledge asked. Leandro saw a good many holes in front, but thought it might not be politic to say so. He simply agreed. Rutledge nodded and let his lip fall back into place. It was something of a relief.
"Teeth never have been much good," Rutledge said indifferently. "When I get working again and can afford me a good set of dentures, I'm going to have all of 'em jerked. Fuck 'em. Point is, I had my 2 front teeth there on top before I headed up to Haven week before last to check on Gramp. Hell, they wasn't even loose."
"They fell out when you started to get close to Haven?"
"Didn't fall out," Rutledge finished his beer. "I puked 'em out."
"Oh," Leandro had replied faintly.
"You know, another brood go down good. Talkin's
thirsty work, I know," Leandro said, signaling the waitress. He was over his limit, but he found he could use another one himself.
4.
Alvin Rutledge wasn't the only person who had tried to visit a friend or relative in Haven during July, nor the only one to become ill and turn back. Using the voting lists and area phone books as a starting point, Leandro turned up 3 people who told stories similar to Rutledge's. He uncovered a 4th incident through pure coincidence, or almost pure. His mother knew he was following up some aspect of his big story and happened to mention that her friend Eileen Pulsifer had a friend who lived down in Haven. Eileen was 15 years older than Leandro's mother, which put her close to 70. Over tea and cloyingly sweet ginger snaps, she told Leandro a story similar to those he had already heard. Mrs. Pulsifer's friend was Mary Jacqueline, whose grandson was Tommy Jacqueline.
They had visited back and forth for more than 40 years and often played in local bridge tournaments. This summer she hadn't seen Mary at all, not even once. She'd spoken to her on the phone, and she seemed fine. Her excuses always sounded believable. But all the same, something about them. A bad headache, too much baking to do. The family had decided on the spur of the moment to go down to Kennebunk and visit the trolley museum. Wasn't quite right.
They were fine by the one by one, but they seemed odd by the bunch, if you see what I mean.
She offered the cookies.
More snaps?
No, thank you, Leandro said.
Oh, go ahead. I know you boys. Your mother taught you to be polite, but no boy ever born could turn down a ginger snap. Now you just go on and take what you hanker for.
Smiling dutifully, Leandro took another ginger snap. Settling back and folding her hands on her tight, round belly, Mrs. Pulsifer went on.
I begun to think something might be wrong. I still think that maybe something's wrong, truth to tell. First thing to cross my mind was that maybe Mary didn't want to be my friend anymore. Then maybe I did or said something to offend her. But no, says I to myself, if I'd done something, I guess she'd tell me. After 40 years of friendship, I guess she would. Besides, she didn't really sound cool to me, you know?
But she did sound different. Eileen Pulsifer nodded decisively.
I am? And that got me thinking that maybe she was sick. That maybe, God save us, her doctor had found a cancer of something inside her, and she didn't want any of her old friends to know. So I called up Vera and I said, we're going to go down to Haven, Vera, and see Mary. We ain't going to tell her we're coming, and that way she can't call us off. You get ready, Vera, I says, because I'm coming by your house at 10 o'clock, and if you ain't ready, I'm going to go without you.
Vera is
Vera Anderson in Derry. Just about my best friend in the whole world, John, except for Mary and your mother. And your mother was down in Monmouth visiting her sister that week.
Leandro remembered it well. A week of such peace and quiet was a week to be treasured. So the two of you headed down?
Are you?
And you got sick?
Sick? I thought I was dying. My heart!
She clapped a hand dramatically over one breast.
It was beating so fast. My head started to ache. I got a nosebleed. And Vera got scared. She says, turn around, Eileen, right now. You got to get to the hospital right away. Well, I turned around somehow. I don't hardly remember how. The world was spinning so. And by then, my mouth was bleeding, and two of my teeth fell out. Right out of my head. You ever hear the beat of it?
No, he lied, thinking of Alvin Rutledge.
Where did it happen? Why, I told you. We were going to see Mary Jacklin, yes.
But were you actually in Haven when you got sick? And which way did you come in?
Oh, I see. No, we weren't. We were on Old Derry Road in Troy.
Close to Haven, then?
Oh, about a mile from the town line. I'd been feeling sick for a little time, whoopsie, you know, but I didn't want to say so to Vera. I kept hoping that I would feel better.
Vera Anderson hadn't gotten sick, and this troubled Leandro. It didn't fit. Vera hadn't gotten a bloody nose, nor lost any teeth.
No, she didn't get sick at all, Mrs. Pulsifer said, except with Tara. I guess she was sick with that. For me, and for herself, too, I imagine.
How do you mean?
Well, that road's awful empty. She thought I was going to pass out. I almost did. It might have been 15, 20 minutes before someone came along.
She couldn't have driven you?
God bless you, John. Vera's had muscular dystrophy for years. She wears great big metal braces on her legs. Cruel-looking things they are. Like something you'd expect to see in a torture chamber. Just about makes me cry sometimes to see her.
5. At 9:45 on the morning of August 15th, Leandro crossed into the town of Troy. His stomach was tight with anticipation, and, let's face it, folks, a tingle of fear. His skin felt cold. "I may get sick. I may get sick. And if I do, I'm going to leave about 90 feet of rubber reversing out of the area. Got that?"
"I got it, boss," he answered himself. "I got it. I got it."
"You may lose some teeth, too," he cautioned himself. But the loss of a few teeth seemed a small price to pay for a story which might win him a Pulitzer Prize. And, just as important, one which would surely turn David bright, green with envy. He passed through Troy Village, where everything seemed fine, if a little slower than usual. The first jag in the normal run of things came about a mile further south, from a direction he wouldn't have expected. He had been listening to WZON out of Bangor. Now the normally strong AM signal began to waver and flutter. Leandro could hear one, no two, no three other stations mixed in with its signal. He frowned. That sometimes happened at night, when radiant cooling thinned the atmosphere and allowed radio signals to travel further. But he had never heard of it happening on an AM bank in the morning, not even during those periods of optimum radio transmission conditions which ham operators call the skip. He ran the tuner on the Dodge's radio and was amazed as a flood of conflicting transmissions poured out of the speakers. Rock and roll, country and western, and classical music stepped all over each other. Somewhere in the background he could hear Paul Harvey extolling Amway. He turned the dial further and caught a clear transmission so surprising he pulled over. He sat staring at the radio with big eyes. It was speaking in Japanese. He sat and waited for the inevitable clarification. "This lesson in beginner's Japanese has been brought to you by your local Kyanize paint dealer," something like that. The announcer finished. Then came the Beach Boys' "Be True to Your School" in Japanese. Leandro continued to tune down the kilohertz band with a hand that shook. It was much the same all the way. As it did at night, the tangle of voices and music got worse as he tuned toward the higher frequencies. At last the tangle grew so severe it began to frighten him. It was the auditory equivalent of a squirming mass of snakes. He turned the radio off and sat behind the wheel, eyes wide, body thrumming slightly, like a man on low-grade speed. What is this? Foolish to speculate when the answer lay no more than 6 miles up ahead, always assuming he could uncover it, of course. Oh, I think you'll uncover it. You may not like it when you do, but yeah, I think you'll uncover it with no trouble at all. Leandro looked around. The hay in the field on his right was long and shaggy. Too long and shaggy for August. There hadn't been any first cutting in early July. Somehow he didn't think there was going to be any August cutting either. He looked left and saw a tumble-down barn surrounded by rusty auto parts. The corpse of a 57 Studebaker was decaying in the barn's maw. The windows seemed to stare at Leandro. There were no people to stare, at least not that he could see. A very quiet, very polite little voice spoke up inside him, the voice of a child at a tea party that has become decidedly scary. "I would like to go home, please." Yes, home to mother. Home in time to watch the afternoon soaps with her. She would be glad to see him back with his scoop, maybe even more glad to see him back without it. They'd sit and eat cookies and drink coffee. They would talk. She would talk, rather, and he would listen. That was how it always was, and it really wasn't that bad. She could be an irritating thing sometimes, but she was
safe.
Safe, yeah. That was it, safe. And whatever was going on south of Troy on this dozy summer afternoon, it wasn't at all safe.
"I would like to go home, please."
Right. There had probably been times when Woodward and Bernstein felt that way when Nixon's boys were really putting the squeeze on. Bernard Fall had probably felt that way when he got off the plane in Saigon for the last time. When you saw the TV news correspondents in trouble spots like Lebanon and Tehran, they only looked cool, calm, and collected. Viewers never had a chance to inspect their shorts. "The story is out there, and I'm going to get it. And when I collect my Pulitzer Prize, I can say I owe it all to David Bright and my secret Superman wristwatch. He put the Dodge in gear again and drove on toward Haven. 6. He hadn't gone a mile before he began to feel ill. He thought this must be a physical symptom of his fear and ignored it. Then, when he began to feel worse, he asked himself, as one is apt to do when he realizes that the nausea sitting in his stomach, like a small dark cloud, is not going away, what he had eaten. There was no blame to be laid in that direction. He hadn't been afraid when he got up that morning, but he had been feeling a lot of anticipation and high-spirited tension. As a result, he had refused the usual bacon and scrambled eggs and settled for tea and dry toast. That was all. "I would like to go home," the voice was now more shrill. Leandro pushed on, teeth clamped grimly together. The scoop was in Haven. If he couldn't get into Haven, there would be no scoop. You couldn't hit him if you couldn't see him. QED. Less than a mile from the town line, the day was eerily, utterly dead. A series of beeping, booping, and buzzing noises began to come from the back seat, startling him so badly that he cried out and pulled over to the side of the road again. He looked in back and was at first unable to credit what he was seeing. It had to be, he thought, a hallucination brought on by his increasing nausea. When he and his mother had been in Halifax this past weekend, he had taken his nephew Tony out for a Dairy Queen. Tony, whom Leandro privately thought was an ill-mannered little snot, had sat in the back playing with a plastic toy that looked a bit like the handset of a prince's phone. This toy was called Merlin, and it ran on a computer chip. It played 4 or 5 simple games, which called for simple feats of memory or the ability to identify a simple mathematical series. Leandro remembered it had also played tic-tac-toe. Anyway, Tony must have forgotten it, and now it was going crazy in the back seat, its red lights flashing on and off in random patterns. But were they, or just a little too fast for him to catch, making its simple series of sounds again and again and again? It was running by itself. No. No, I hit a pothole or something, that's all. Jogged its switch, got it going. But he could see the small black switch on the side. It was pushed to off. But Merlin went on booping and beeping and buzzing. It reminded him of a Vegas slot machine paying off a big jackpot. The thing's plastic case began to smoke. The plastic itself was sinking, drooling, running like tallow. The lights flashed faster, faster. Suddenly they all went on at once, bright red, and the gadget emitted a strangled buzzing sound. The case cracked open. There was a brittle shower of plastic shards. The seat cover started to smolder underneath it. Ignoring his stomach, Leandro got up on his knees and knocked it on the floor. There was a charred spot on the seat where Merlin had lain. "What is this?" The answer irrelevant, nearly a scream. "I would like to go home now, please." The ability to isolate a simple mathematical series. Did I think that? The John Leandro that flunked general math in high school? Do you mean it? Never mind that. Just bug out. No. He put the Dodge in gear and drove on again. He had gone less than 20 yards when he thought suddenly, with crazy exhilaration, "The ability to isolate a simple mathematical series indicates the existence of a general case, doesn't it? You could express it this way, come to think of it. AX times 2 plus BXY equals CY times 2 plus DX plus EY plus F minus 0. Yep. It'll work as long as A, B, C, D, and F are constants. I think. Yeah. You bet. But you couldn't let A, B, or C be 0. That'd fuck it for sure. Let F take care of itself. Ha!" Leandro felt like puking, but he still uttered a shrill, triumphant laugh. All at once, he felt as if his brain had lifted off right through the top of his skull. Although he didn't know it, having pretty much dozed through that part of nerd math, he had reinvented the general quadratic equation in 2 variables, which can indeed be used to isolate components in a simple mathematical series. It blew his mind. A moment later, blood burst from his nose in an amazing flood. That was the end of John Leandro's first effort to get into Haven. He threw the gear shift into reverse and backed unsteadily up the road, weaving from side to side, right arm hooked over the front seat, blood pouring onto the shoulder of his shirt as he stared out through the back window with watering eyes. He backed up for almost a mile, then turned around in a driveway. He looked down at himself. His shirt was drenched with blood, but he felt better, a little better, he amended. Still, he didn't linger. He drove back to Troy Village and parked in front of the general store. He walked in, expecting the usual gathering of old men to stare at his bloody shirt with silent Yankee surprise. But only the shopkeeper was there, and he didn't look surprised at all. Not at the blood, not at Leandro's question about any shirts he might have in stock.
"Look like your nose might have bled a titch," the storekeeper said mildly, and showed Leandro a selection of T-shirts.
An inordinately large selection for such a small store as this, Leandro thought. He was slowly getting hold of himself, although his head still ached and his stomach still felt sour and unsteady. The flow of blood from his nose had scared him very badly.
"You could say that," Leandro said. He allowed the old man to thumb through the shirts for him, because there was tacky blood still drying on his own hands. They were sized S, M, L, and XL. "Where the hell is Troy, Maine?" some said. On others there was a lobster and the slogan, "I got the best piece of tail I ever had in Troy, Maine." On others there was a large black fly which looked like a monster from outer space. "The Maine state bird," these proclaimed.
"You sure do have lots of shirts," Leandro said, pointing to a "Where the hell" in an M size. He thought the lobster shirt was amusing, but thought his mother would be less than wild about the innuendo.
"Yeah?"
the storekeeper said.
"Have to have a lot. Sell a lot."
"Tourists?" Leandro's mind was already racing ahead, trying to figure out what came next. He had thought he was onto something big. Now he believed it was one hell of a lot bigger than even he had believed.
"Some," the storekeeper said. "But there ain't been many down this way this summer. Mostly I sell them to folks like you."
"Like me?"
"I am. Folks with bloody noses."
Leandro gaped at the storekeeper.
"Their noses bleed. They wreck their shirts," the storekeeper said. "Same way you wrecked yours. They want a new one. And if they're just locals, like I expect you are, they ain't got no luggage and no changes. So they stop first place to come to and buy a new one. I don't blame 'em. Driving around in a shirt all over blood like yours would make me puke. Why, I've had ladies in here this summer, nice-looking ladies, too, dressed to the nines, who smelt like guts in a hog's head."
The storekeeper cackled, showing a mouth that was perfectly toothless. Leandro said slowly,
"Let me get this straight. Other people come back from Haven with bloody noses? It's not just me?"
"Just you? Hell no. Shoulda goddamn. The day they buried Ruth McCausland, I sold 15 shirts. That one day. I was thinking about retiring on the proceeds and moving to Florida."
The storekeeper cackled again.
"They was all out of towners."
He said this as if it explained everything. And perhaps in his mind it did.
"Couple of 'em was still spoutin' when they come in here. Noses like fountains. Ears, too, sometimes. Shit a goddamn."
"And nobody knows about this?"
The old man looked at Leandro from wise eyes.
"You do, sonny," he said.